was invited to say something about the influence of the workerist or autonomia movement in Germany, basically. I come from a group, Wildcat, which is influenced by the autonomia. They started as a local collective in the late 70s, translated a lot of the stuff into German. And I think we're more influenced by the very early text by Al-Quarti, which is not really translated into English. So the English translation tend to start, let's say, with Bologna or Negri's around the 70s, Tronti maybe. But the earlier text by Al-Quarti, which is mainly about the workers' factory inquiries, this is not too much translated, just as an introduction. The Wildcat's still going on. So we tried to translate some of the stuff into English. You can find it partly on Libcom or on the Wildcat website. I prepared some notes. It's fairly historical. It's basically relating to some of the bits that Kieran already mentioned, the Italian history. And I would just overlay it with, let's say, the German history at the same time. We see some parallels and we see some very kind of significant differences. We can say, okay, Second World War, we had in both countries a kind of period of reconstruction from very different levels. I mean, in Germany, the infrastructure was destroyed or largely destroyed during the war, but it already existed on a much higher kind of level than compared to India. To Italy. We had a Marshall Plan, which was significant for both countries, for Italy and Germany, a kind of Cold War, let's say the Cold War in the background, the Marshall Plan money streaming in, and also politically influencing the industrial landscape. We can see the way, for example, the unions were shaped, the DGB, the German, whatever TUC equivalent was largely shaped by also by the US occupying forces, and said, okay, we don't want a kind of the post-war period is always socially fragile, and we want to have a controlled union landscape, so very strict labor law. And we have a similar kind of parallel in Italy, where the US combined with the Marshall Plan, like investment, they said, okay, we want to have the political unions. They basically split the union landscape into various kind of politically affiliated unions. We heard about the disarmament of the partisan movement in Italy and the incorporation of the Communist Party. In Germany, well, there was no resistance as such, as we know. But there was a general strike, which is not that well known, in 48 in the parts that was occupied by the US forces. And it was basically involving about 8 million people, demanding the nationalization of the main industry. And the US had no, or the US German capital kind of regime that existed, said, no, we won't have it. So basically, against all the kind of democratic means that they wanted to kind of portray. This kind of general strike was undermined. There was a strike, let's say, they forbid the strike, and they said, no, we won't have the nationalization of the key industries. So that's, let's say, a certain kind of parallel in the post-war situation. Then a very rapid industrial development, which was also based on the very low wages that was mentioned. I think the wages in Italy at the time was about, I wrote down, a fifth of the wages of 1913. So it was very like the wage levels were dropped significantly. You had in Italy a migration from the south of the country. In Germany, a lot of the German refugees from the eastern, let's say, former German enclaves came, and they were used and also treated as the refugees for cheap labor on construction sites, exploited by landlordism of local people. So there's a certain parallel. Later on, the migration in Germany became much more centrally industrially organized with the guest workers. Then a lot of Italian coming in, Spanish, Greece, Turkish. We didn't have that in Italy. That was already then a kind of significant difference, the racist underlayering, maybe we could say that, of the German working class. Mm-hmm. These so-called guest workers, which came in then in the late 50s, early 60s, they were employed in the main industry, not like today where, let's say, migrants are mainly pushed into the fringes, let's say, cleaning, restaurant economy, service. They were employed in the main kind of steel plants, car plants that came up. They were hired, and the checks were already done in, for example, Turkey. They had like contractors. They had it was very kind of centrally organized. They had health checks over there. Only would, you know, young people, healthy people, would be allowed to come in. They were put into dormitory camps, which a kind of curfew in the sense that they had to stay in after 10. It was very like segregated from the rest of so-called German working class or working class in Germany. I think another kind of parallel in terms of the time, but with very different, let's say, outcome, was 56, where the Communist Party in Italy had a kind of the major crisis in terms of whatever the Stalinist, you know, the I don't know, was it the 12th Congress of the Soviet Union Communist Party or whatever, when they announced the Stalinist atrocities. That was that gave a blow to the Communist Party in Italy. In Germany at that point, 56, the Communist Party was legalized. So we have a different kind of way that a regime at that time would kind of deal with a so-called Communist Party, an incorporation where they could, or kind of it was already kind of a certain kind of social democratic function of the Communist Party in Italy. And in Germany at that time, Communist Party was much smaller, and potentially for the plans of the conservative government, of Marshall Plan, they decided to illegalize it. And it was combined with a severe repression, in the sense of who would say I'm a Communist Party member would lose a job, for example, if they were in the public sector. I mean, it was a kind of post-fascist blow against whatever was left of communist tradition. So they didn't have to undergo this kind of Stalinist, crisis, because they were pushed in the underground. So if we compare maybe 68, I mean, in Italy we heard like 62, there wasn't a kind of the first time that this new working class would enter the stage with Piazza Statuto. There was not really an equivalent in Germany at that time. We already, I think, the division of mass workers at that time being also dominantly guest workers created a whole different layer that probably at that time didn't exist in Italy in that way. 68, if we compare the student movement in Germany, I think the theoretically also, if we see like the theoretical expressions of the student movement was very much focused on the question of fascism. How could fascism have happened? I mean, they went through the question of democracy. They had to explain what is this East German socialism. I mean, they had to deal a lot with the question of whatever freedom. And so we can say they were much less interested or much less focused on the question of, okay, what is this working class? Is it a source of liberation? They were much more concerned with, okay, we talk about socialism, but we have to answer the question of, you know, tendencies towards totalitarianism. East German, Stalinist Germany, and fascism. You had the Frankfurter Schule, Frankfurter School, which was basically saying, you know, one-dimensional individual in the modern society. So they, their kind of relation to working class was completely, at that time, very abstract. It was rather like, okay, Vietnam War and their own history, German history, fascism, and so on. But it also had a material basis in the sense, I think, that the technicians, let's say, in Germany, the division between, let's say, the technician in a production process and the mass workers was much more defined. The technicians in Nazi Germany, they were much more tied up with the state. They had to control also the large amount of whatever bonded or, let's say, slave labor. Whereas in Italy, I think the technicians were from a different they were still attached more to a communist movement. They were, so the students at university who would think I would be a technician at some point in Germany were much more likely to think of themselves as, I don't know, an agent of science or an agent of maybe capital even, or of a good of the state. So that was also, I think, a difference in the terms of Italian and German student movement. So yeah, in Italy at that time, you had at Pirelli, for example, the first technicians who said, yeah, we're like, you know, we organize ourselves and we are workers. So that was also where Bologna would see the main link between, you know, how a link could be imagined between the workers' movement and the student movement was this figure of the technician. In Germany, the technician was always, you know, that's a technocrat, that's very, as well, the kind of Nazi hang-up. 69 in Germany, we had the so-called September strikes, which was a large-scale, probably wildcat strikes in most of the cases in the steel industry. So we had another parallel, 67, a recession, both in, I think, all over Europe. So the first kind of 60s, let's say, working class, you know, wages are developing. Finally, then 67, a recession, the first time that, you know, this kind of new working class had to face the prospect of, you know, shit could happen to us as well, triggered both, I think, in Germany and in Italy, the 69, like, upswing of struggles. We saw Fiat being occupied in Italy, and 69, you had the September strikes in Germany. Was, as I said, mainly steel industry in the Ruhr area, in total about 140,000 workers. Typically 7 days wildcat strike, wage demands of 10-15%. So it was definitely a kind of a significant worker struggle, but it kept quite separate from the students. I mean, the students at that time, they had there were not many organic links. The first kind of ideological links happened, like, okay, student movement is going down, we have to somehow connect with the working class, but it was not out of an actual coming together of movements, not like in Italy where you had the whatever workers' students' assemblies, Fiat occupation, Lotta Continua. That didn't happen in Germany. In Germany, after, let's say, the demise of the student movement, you saw the emergence of all this, what we call K-Gruppen, let's say K groups, which would be like all this Stalinist, Maoist, new communist parties. They normally had like six other kind of letters as abbreviation, KPDAO, KPDML, KPDML Maoist, and all that. So that was probably also an expression of that, the students had no kind of, they had a very kind of ideological view, this is the working class, and somehow we can't really approach them organically, so we have to take the red flags and our red books. And it was very kind of, probably in a similar way it exists in Italy, but much less kind of, let's say, rigid and theatrical. Some of these students also then went to work in factories and just kind of tried to dissolve this kind of gap by becoming workers, cutting their hairs and all that. A more, let's say, a less... maybe a more organic way where the groups that were influenced by the autonomous movement, meaning Lotta Continua, Potere Operaio, and they were like based mainly in Frankfurt, Munich, Hamburg and Cologne. They published a newspaper called Wir wollen alles, We Want Everything, which was basically a slogan in Italy. They translated it crudely into German, and that was then their newspaper, and the name of the newspaper. They were initially focusing on the factory, mainly on this kind of new migrant, what they also called mass worker. So, for example, at Ford plant in Cologne, mainly Turkish people. In Munich, at BMW, a lot of Italians. These workers started with some, like, what was called then the Turkish strikes, with wildcat strikes. The first started, I think, in 71 and 73. So they were probably a kind of equivalent to the Fiat strikes of this kind of assembly line workers, but they happened under different conditions. They happened often with a very kind of racist division towards the rest of the workforce. But these groups, I'll just mention, for example, one was called Arbeitersache in Munich, or Proletarischer Kampf, Proletarian Struggle in Hamburg. They try to get in touch with these workers. A lot of them, especially in Munich, were in touch with Lotta Continua. So there was somehow a similar workers figure that had links, for example, to situation in Spain or in Italy, to the political situation. And political organizational links came together for a short period of time. So this, let's say, phase where the unorthodox wing of the student movement came together with this kind of migrant workers in the main industry was probably from 70 to 72, 73. At that time, yeah, the first group started like to work together with Lotta Continua, Potere Operaio. If we see this documentary, there was a link between the Hamburg comrades and the comrades here in the chemical industrial area. By 73, with the onset of the crisis, the inflation, the oil shock, we can see another parallel. The main strikes become more defensive, both in probably in Italy and in Germany. These groups shifted their focus from the factory to the what they call the terrain or the living sphere. You had more, let's see, squatting of houses together with immigrants, for example, in Frankfurt and Hamburg. But it went into a kind of, and that's maybe also parallel to Italy, into a situation of, yeah, more of a confrontation, a street, classical street confrontation. I just mentioned, for example, in Frankfurt, the so-called Revolutionäre Kampf, Revolutionary Struggle, they occupied houses together with some immigrants, but also with the so-called leftover of the student movement, had rent strikes. And in 74, about 2,500 cops evicted these squads, came to a dead end, some rioting on the streets, similar like Eckhoffstrasse in Hamburg, which was evicted by 600 cops with machine guns. I mean, it was basically a shift, but that ended also in a kind of, similar to Italy, in a kind of more heated up, militarized kind of in the form of struggle. We know the other parallels, Red Army faction, Brigate Rosso. I think what's interesting is that the autonomy, in the sense of a concept, became, let's say, when after 77, at least in Germany, somehow it opened up space for various different ways how the regime as well solved the crisis. You had the Autonomen, which thought, okay, we create autonomous zones, all the squads, a little bit of the, let's say, youth center movement. They said, okay, we are autonomous. We are outside somehow of society. A lot of these revolutionaries struggled, this group in Frankfurt, and of these groups who came up, they transformed into the Green Party. A bit like maybe Big Flame here, who came from also from, let's say, focusing on Fort Merseyside, then on the question of housing, and then entering into Labour Party. Maybe that was a parallel as well. But for them, like local politics, getting engaged with the community, local politics, Green Party, also fitted this kind of idea of autonomy to a certain extent. I mean, there was a lot of debate at that time. And also on the worker side, a lot of these guest workers who were involved in these struggles during the early 70s fought their way out of the factory, also of the restructuring, opened their pizza restaurant, their kind of kebab shop. So they're out of the first generation of industrial workers, you had then an established layer also of, let's say, a, I don't know, don't like the word, but a petty bourgeoisie of these guest workers who became export-import small enterprises. So that was somehow the bit of an ironic end of the autonomy dissolved into the small units of commerce and whatever. Yeah, Joschka Fischer is a very well-known example. He was in this, let's say, autonomous movement in the early 70s. He went, formed the Green Party and became foreign minister and basically justified the attack on Yugoslavia or Serbia at the time by trying to prevent another Auschwitz. So it was the first time that German army was used outside of Germany after Second World War under that kind of semi-anarchist Greeny kind of foreign minister. So that's irony for you. Influence, I think the main thing, apart from all the experience for the working class that we can see in Italy, for example, from 69 till end of the 70s, all these forms of organization that went way beyond anything imaginable and by any kind of Communist Party kind of thinking, actual fusion of appropriation, both of production process and products, student workers actually coming together and all that. But we can also see how the counter-revolution works. I mean, I just mentioned these kind of the main features of counter-revolution at the time. It started, as we have seen, like with the immediate like strategy of tension, with these kind of whatever bomb scares, creating a situation that would allow like paranoia and cops coming in. But that's just like a first blow. You had a union reform, so the to this kind of formal struggle where we say we are all delegates and we don't want this, we don't have this usual form of negotiation. They had the union reform in 1970, which was like a bit like shop stewards kind of structure. They said, okay, you can vote your delegates on, you know, and they can be on a rotating kind of a structure on your department floor. That was coming out in the 70s, and initially the left thought, okay, this is way, you know, we can use it. But bit by bit, if you see all the kind of elements of counter-revolution come together, you see it became a part of it as well, reintroducing a form of representation at that time. Then obviously fiscal policies, like inflationary policies by the state at the time after the oil shock 73. So wage demands were immediately kind of counteracted by high inflation. Introduction of the planning commission, like the meeting where unions, bosses and state would meet and somehow negotiate a kind of wage productivity deal. That was one main outcome as well after the 69 movement. Historical compromise, definitely part of it. And last but not least, I would say the restructuring, like actual restructuring of production, introduction of microelectronics, mass layoffs at Fiat 1980. So all this kind of, within a very, like, less than or about a decade, you had this kind of very modern ways of dealing with revolution. The focus in hindsight is always on let's say, on the repression. I would say that more to learn is about, okay, what can you do if the main factory disperse? How can you understand a new form of organization on a level where, you have to deal with unemployment, workshop economy, big factories still at the same time without like an ideological reaction like Negri did, the social worker, basically trying to be, let's say, voluntaristic and say we are the party, attack on the state, armed party, the social worker. I mean, I think that's the main kind of thing to debate. How can you imagine self-organization still on the level of social production, but in a more dispersed kind of environment? Maybe this documentary is 50 minutes long, and I would say some bits of it are very, very good, and some other bits are quite good.